14th, 1973, 10:30 a.m. I will be interviewing Mr. Benjamin E. Bautel, Benjamin R. Bautel, descendant of a pioneer Bay City family. The topics to be discussed are the Mitchell Bautel Company, the origins of the family, tugboat business, how the family happened to come to the Saginaw Valley area, and what were the day-to-day operations of the company. Mr. Bautel, what originally brought the family to this area?
Well, I guess from my years, remember it, they were on outside of Flint. And when my great-grandfather, parents died, father died, they moved to Bay City and opened up the rooming or hotel like here, because they couldn't operate the farm with my great-grandfather, who was too young to operate the farm. That explains it in that article. I really don't know why, except that I think the life was supposed to be easier here because Flint wasn't much of an area in those days.
And that was Mr. Daniel Bautel, your great-grandfather.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what is your recollection of how they happened to start in the tugboat business?
Well, just from what people have told me, they say that my grandfather was never had time to go to school. He was too busy earning a living for his mother, and somehow or other he got a job on the as a deckhand on a boat, and he liked it, and he could see the possibilities with all the lumber mills in the river and the fact that lumber was running out right close to here, and that they were going to have to bring logs into it.
How old would he have been at that time?
Oh, gosh, I hadn't any idea.
Young boy, though.
Yeah, he'd been a young man. And he didn't have any money. But in those days, if your character was good and you could...
Gosh. Now I think we're recording again. Let me stop.
Well, a whaleback is like a boat. It's like a modern submarine, only it doesn't submerge. It semi-floats on the surface of the water, but you can seal it all up so that the waves can run right over the whole boat without having to worry about it. And it's got enough buoyancy so you can load it full of coal or wood or anything else, and then tow. You could tow two or three or four of them on the Great Lakes out there. And he had quite a fleet of those at one time. And they even went down into the East Coast along Boston and built some down there to try to use them on the ocean. But evidently they didn't work on the ocean because either the stevedores wouldn't handle them or the water was too rough or something or other, because that never worked out very good. But then he bought a couple of transports on the Great Lakes. One was called the Sibley, and the other was called the Twin Sisters. And I have pictures of those home. They're quite a nice-looking boat. And he used to ply on the Great Lakes, delivering merchandise, and same as the boats do today, hauling freight from different ports to different ports. But they only operated on the Great Lakes.
Now, that was in addition to the tug business?
Yeah.
Now, earlier in the portion that we didn't get, you mentioned that he had a fleet of how many?
Well, I'd say they tell me that at one time he controlled over 40 tugs. I don't know whether I can't verify that.
And what were the sizes?
Oh, they say they were varied from little small ones that were used to scurry around in the rivers and harbors, and to the great big ones that where they say were anywhere from 150 to 230, 40 feet long. You can see those in the picture there, those two big front ones there. They're big tugs.
And they would have a crew of how many?
Well, I'm just guessing, but I'm guessing there'd be about 8 to 10 men on them. Of course, in those days, they didn't work on shifts, you know. They worked on, when the job was done, they were done. They worked day and night. They didn't 8 hours and then go off and have the rest of the day off or whatever.
Now, what you mentioned, shift, how many days at a time would they operate? How long would it take them to go up on a one trip, and how many months out of the year?
Well, of course, they worked in those days. They worked from the time the ice went out until it froze in the fall, and it would vary, of course, from year to year.
March to November, December,
yeah.
Then?
Well, it could run from April to December, yeah. Mm-hmm. But in those days, the water was a lot purer, and so it froze harder and deeper and lasted longer than it does now with all the pollution and dirt and everything that's in the water that freezes into the ice. But I'd say April to December would be a good long season.
And you mentioned that the geographic area in which they operated started at the mouth of, say, the Pinconning River and then worked on?
Well, it started from each river and worked on as it worked north as they cut the logs out of the area that each river watershed had. And then they would move to the next river and bring a log, because all the logs were all floated down rivers in those days. They didn't have modern trucks and Caterpillar tractors and all that stuff to haul them around. They had to be moved on with teams of horses. And of course they had those big high wheels that they would lift one end of the log up in the air, and then teams would drag it, or help the weight would be suspended on a wheel. But the teams had to drag the wheels, and of course there was a limit to how far they could go with them.
And then as the logging industry moved farther north, you say that the company even went up to Canada?
Well, they had to move into Canada and what is now is known as Little Current and Thessalon area, where they were still cutting, getting pine logs out of there, coming they, down out of their rivers.
Would that be just one tug that would go up and bring?
Well, yeah, one. Well, of course they had many tugs, but there'd be one tug to one raft, and while it was in the Great Lakes, sometimes they would have a tug on the stern when they got into a river to help to guide it around bends and curves and stuff like that, because a raft doesn't handle too good when it's so deep in the water.
And how many feet of lumber or how many logs in a raft?
Well, they say that there was anywhere from 2 to 3 or 3.5 million feet of board lumber in each raft.
And if these tugs were steam-powered, would that be wood or coal?
Well, they tell me most of them burn wood. We see from the sawmills, there was wood all up and down the banks of the rivers, and all they had to do was load the slab wood on from the bark from the trees that they had been cutting up into timber. And, of course, there was all kinds of logs and stuff available even in the remote rivers that they could load onto the boats that they threw into the boilers.
Well, could they make a trip all the way down from Canada with enough?
Well, I can't verify that, but I think they used to have to. I think they used to have some auxiliary fuel brought to them, or another tug come up and they'd go off and get some more fuel, and another tug would take on and tow it till it ran out of fuel. Then I suppose gradually they probably. As the mines opened up around Bay City here, they probably went to burning coal in the boilers in this area, because we had a lot of coal mines at one time here.
Well, then, as the logging industry, I wanted to ask one more question. How the logs were put together, I see by this picture, with a chain to a rafting pin. Was that it?
Well, they call them dogs. Or pins. and they were all hooked together with these chains and pins so that they wouldn't come apart. And even as it was, sometimes they get into a bad storm and the whole raft would break up, and then they'd have to go and pick them all up again and put them back together and bring them on into Bay City.
Not an easy way to make a living.
It sure wasn't. It's a hard work.
Well, then as the tug company had to go farther and farther north, I presume it became less profitable. And how did your grandfather, Benjamin Boutel, adjust to this? Did he go into other enterprises?
Well, yeah, he was a very energetic and man, and you'd almost say he was a real entrepreneur, because he helped organize the Michigan Sugar Company and the Bay City Sugar Company, and then started a farm, which is the acreage and the buildings that he put up out in Hampton Township are still standing. And then he has an interest in the Alaska Steamship Company at one time, where they were running passenger boats and transports up to Alaska from San Francisco.
And how then did he get into that?
Don't ask me, I don't know. And then at one time, he met up with a Dr. Stone, and he was one of 10 men that started the Pacific Portland Cement Company in Northern California, which is now part of the Ideal Cement Company. It's known today, Ideal Basic Cement Company.
So, and he was instrumental in starting a number of businesses.
Oh, he was, that's what I say, he was a going guy.
Now, how did he happen that you mentioned he started a farm? What was the purpose of his starting this farm?
Well, they tell me that the reason he did it was to prove that this low area around here and in the thumb could be, the water could be taken off of it, and then it would make wonderful rich ground to grow sugar beets, so that the sugar beet factories would have plenty of sugar beets to operate with.
Did your grandfather live in Bay City all of his life?
Well, he moved here as a small boy, and then he was here until he died. He had several residences, and most of his life, after most of his married life, was spent on Madison between 4th and 5th. He had one house on 4th Street in Madison, and then he built a new one, which was on 5th and Madison. And that was quite a palatial place in those days. It had marble fireplaces in each bedroom and each living room, and a complete kitchen and dining room and office area in the basement, which I suppose was much cooler for in the summertime. And then he had the same thing on the first floor.
Is that house still standing?
No, gradually went to rack and ruin, and the county bought it from the estate as a children's home, detention home, and then the state insisted that was dangerous to house the youngsters in there, so it was then torn down and made into a parking lot for the county offices.
I noticed in reading one of these books that he was also instrumental in forming the Michigan Chicory Company. I'd be curious to know a little bit about the background.
I never even knew that. You sure that chicory? Never heard of that.
Now, what you just said, he was a founder of what is now the People's National Bank?
One of them. It's now the People's National Bank and Trust Company.
What about the Marine Iron Company?
Well, that's a... It was a company that he formed, and it was situated over here on Water Street, just beyond where the old Ford garage was there. You remember where the Ford garage was?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next building over was the over to the corner was the Marine Iron Works, and they used to do a lot of castings and making things for the different boats that needed, like propellers and shafts and all that kind of stuff. And then across the street from that, where the Jennison Steel Warehouse is, he owned all that piece of property, and that's where he had his coal yard and building supply. I say, he was a going guy.
There wasn't really, I mean, in other words, he took advantage of
whatever, if there was any demand or any place that he could make money or thought he could, he'd give her a whirl. Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid to try anything.
Now, I was going to ask earlier, where were most of his tugs built?
That I couldn't answer. I wouldn't even know.
They weren't built locally, though.
Well, I suppose some of them were, sure. I imagine they must have been here. I don't know, Wheeler Shipyard or some of those places must have built some of them for him. But I've never heard that ever discussed.
Now, did he bring, when they brought back the lumber, did he bring those under contract to a particular mill or just...
Oh, I imagine, yeah. Yeah, the logs were sold to a certain lumber company, and then he was, would be like a railroad or a trucking company. It was up to him to deliver them down to their... to the lumber companies. He didn't buy them himself. I know, I'm sure of that.
Well, that reminds me of reading something else about the Bautel Transit Company. Do you know what that...
Well, that's the one I told you that he organized with these two boats, these boats that were hauling supplies and stuff from different ports around, principally from Chicago to Detroit and Cleveland and stuff, places like that.
Have you ever heard any harrowing tales about storms that they encountered, and did he ever lose any of his boats in some of our storms?
I'm sure of that, but I've heard some of the men tell about the wild storms that they went into, but I don't particularly remember any of the boats that he lost in the storm or what have you.
Did he spend any, I'm sure he couldn't have spent much time on those
boats.
Very little.
No, he spent very little time on the boats. He loved to go, and I suppose he went whenever he could, but most of the time he was either, the story goes that he would take a month to go from here to San Francisco to the cement meeting, the annual cement company meeting out there. It would take a month by the time he got out there and got back again on the train.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, he married and had two children.
Well, he had three.
Three
boys. There's my uncle, Fred Bautel, who was Jackie's and Minifred's and Betsy's dad. And then my dad, whose name was Bill, and he had two girls, and then me. I was the last of the Mohicans, and when I, only boy in the, that my grandfather had, grandson that my grandfather
only
had.
Wanted to have the
he had one other son named Benny, and he fell off of a pony when he was a young, 8 or 9 years old, and they developed spinal meningitis and died. They didn't have, know how to, you know, to treat the disease in those days. Whether the pony in the fall had anything to do with it, I don't know, but anyhow, he died when he was quite young, and it was quite a blow to my grandmother and to him also.
Would he have been the youngest child?
Yeah.
Now, the two, your father and your uncle, went their separate ways in business?
Well, after my grandfather died, his estate was divided between my my uncle and my dad. And, of course, my uncle got certain things and my father got certain things. And I don't remember. No, they didn't go their own ways. They just didn't stay in business together, you know what I mean? Which was a terrible mistake. They should have kept the whole thing together, but... they didn't either, for family reasons or something or other. The story goes that the two wives didn't get along, and you know how fighting can go in a family.
That can often happen.
Yeah. And if they'd have kept it together, it would have been could have developed into a tremendous business, because all the potentials were there if they'd have been run and made, you know, expanded and grown and everything else.
A modern day conglomerate.
That's right. That's what it could have been. Sure could have.
Would you have any comments about the logging industry? You know, hindsight is a lot better than foresight, but what would be your comments about the way it was run in view of ecology today?
Well, they didn't have any ecology in those days. They cut everything down that was any commercial size to it, and they didn't ever replant a tree. Now, every tree that's cut today on the West Coast or any place else by these big lumber companies, they not only plant a tree to replace it, they plant about 10 other ones to be sure that the one will replace the one that they cut out of there. And they do it on a scientific basis. They only cut the trees that are reached old age. In other words, they're not going to grow much more. They're not going to get a lot bigger. They don't just go come in and cut everything. And, of course, in those days, a lot of the lumber, timber, were just burnt to get it off the ground, so they go to farming. They just raped the land. There's no question about it.
Do you think it ever occurred to any of them?
No.
Did you ever hear any stories?
All I could think of was how much money they could sell the lumber for. They didn't care what happened to it. They weren't thinking about mm-hmm. that. There was lots of it. They thought there would be no end to it. And they had no notion that they could ever run out of lumber. And they say if they would have planted it with seedlings, today we would have timber as good as they cut down. And it would be as big.
But we wouldn't have had the farming and some of the other
industries.
No, we would have.
They could have done it on a scientific basis. They would have, instead of letting these little woodlots grow up, you know, like you and I are accustomed to see, they would have planted those into nice big trees that would be growing and coming up and being cut down, and then other ones planted so that it would become a commercial lumbering business, like Weyerhaeuser and those outfits. They only cut down what they never cut out more than they replace. And they do it on a recycling thing, so they come around in a circle. They don't just cut everything out of here and then wait and hope that something grows back. They see to it that it does. I can think of like the Eddies and the Smiths and a lot of those other people that were in the lumber business here. All they could think of was how much money they could get and how easily and they could get it so they could move out of Bay City. They didn't want to stay here.
And they did then. They didn't really go into other enterprises or...
you take the... when the lumber was all gone in Michigan, they moved to Minnesota for a while. Cut things on there and they got to the point where it wasn't too good, then they moved to the West Coast and started on the what we call the Western Pine and the Redwoods. Fortunately, now they've got some real strict laws, and they just can't go in and butcher the land like they used to. And they're putting out a lot of big parks in the Redwoods and in the Northwest up there now that virgin lumber is. As it takes so many years, it takes thousands of years for a redwood tree to develop, and it takes hundreds of years for these big giant Norways that they're harvesting up in the Northwest there. But I don't see where we're going to, with any kind of reasonable usage, where we'll ever run out of lumber. It may get a little bit more expensive to get it out and cut it and ship it and so forth, but I think Mother Nature will, with any kind of help, she'll produce more lumber and what have you.
Could there ever be a lumbering, logging industry reestablished in Michigan, or is land too valuable?
Land's too valuable. And of course the taxes are just something terrible for anybody to go into a tree farming business. They can grow, what they have tree farms now are little small plots where they grow Christmas trees and pines like mm-hmm. that are going to be harvested in 10 or 15 years at the most. But to go and plant a tree and then wait 60 or 70 years to get it off of there, it just can't be done.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vautel, for this very interesting interview.